Welcome to the You Triumph podcast, where we explore the triumphs and tribulations of extraordinary leaders from diverse backgrounds. I'm your host, Trevor Sterling, and across the podcast, I hope to inspire success by highlighting that irrespective of social background or personal characteristics, with fair opportunity and the appropriate mindset, ultimately anyone can be successful. From incredible achievements to key life lessons learned, the goal is to shed insights into the mindset, motivations, and stories behind the success. Because you triumph if you believe. Welcome to the You Triumph Breakthrough podcast series. And I'm delighted today to have a guest, somebody I've known for a while, and somebody whose work I absolutely admire. Now, those listening will know that I'm a lawyer, a senior partner at Moore Barlow. And the world of law is very different from the world of the arts. But there are similar things. If I wasn't a lawyer, I think I would have wanted to have been an actor. But sadly, I didn't have those. But it takes a tremendous amount of confidence to go into the acting world. And one of the things that fascinates me with acting is, as opposed to a lawyer, if somebody wants to instruct me, and hopefully many do, and indeed they do, then I'll do a great job for them. But with acting, you have to take rejection after rejection. You have to go for castings and things like that. And so how do you maintain that confidence against the backdrop of the competition that there is for places, the difficulties in being casted for roles? What is it that drives someone to be top of their game in the acting world, particularly if they are a person of colour? So I'm really delighted to welcome Fraser James. James, thank you for joining me today.
Pleasure to be here, Trevor.
So James, we're gonna climb a ladder. So my motto is, don't just aspire to climb the ladder, aspire to be the ladder. A motto you'll know well, because you asked me to send in a gem to the Underexposed exhibition, which we'll come to a bit later on, and that was my gem. So in terms of the ladder, we're going to start with the top of the ladder. What does it feel like in terms of success? What does success look like to you? What have you achieved? The bottom of the ladder, the first rung, how did you get going? And then the middle of the ladder, some of those obstacles and challenges that you had to overcome to get to that successful point. So let's start with the top of the ladder. Just tell us a bit about what you've managed to achieve. Now, I know in acting terms, you've done both films, you've done TV, and you've done stage. So should we start with films? What are the pinch myself moment roles that you've had and films that you've
done? Pinch myself moment. That's a great question, actually. And it's for me, it's actually an easy one to answer, because a few years ago I was fortunate enough to be cast in Terminator Dark Fate alongside Arnold Schwarzenegger and Linda Hamilton. And I recall very well, I arrived on set and I'd been there previously to get costume fittings, etc. But this day I arrived on set to work, and I went into to the costume department. I got my costume, I put that on, and I'd had, American dialect training for the role, and I was playing a character called Major Dean. And I walked into the makeup truck, and to my amazement, Arnold Schwarzenegger was sat right there getting his makeup done. And that was unusual, because normally, the big movie stars, they have their own makeup trailer there and there on their own. It might be the lead and the co-lead that get their makeup done in that particular trailer. But he was just mingled in with the rest of us, which I thought was odd anyway, remarkable. And I sat down, I was like, trying not to look over where he was getting. And then he said, who are you? And I said, my name's Fraser James. And he said, who are you playing? And I said, I'm playing Major Dean. And he said, oh, we've been waiting for you. So I was like, wow, okay. And he said, you look fit. You look like you train. And I said, yeah, I do a bit. He said, well, where are you training? I said, back at the hotel. And he said, no, not tomorrow. Tomorrow you train with me. And I was just like, what? I mean, I was like, what on earth? And I thought he was joking, but to cut that story short, the following morning, I was in bed chilling at around 8 a.m. in the morning. The phone rang and it was Arnold on the phone saying, you know, we're downstairs in reception. And if you remember those cartoons where, you know, you're up from bed in the air, moving in the opposite direction, that was me getting ready to go downstairs to go training with him. But the day when we actually started filming, it was a crazy day because we had a helicopter shot where the new Terminator was flying in on this helicopter. And then I met them in this kind of massive warehouse and exchanged, you know, the something that would help humanity go forward, you know, and beat the Terminators. And it was a scene with him and Linda and the savior of mankind, the new savior of mankind. And this, essentially, the new Terminator found us. I got shot in the chest. Then I got dragged into this van. I got Linda Hamilton up front alongside this other girl driving. And then Arnold's on the side window. And he's firing this cannon up into the sky at this helicopter that's swooping down. And I'm in the lap of the new savior of mankind. And I'm lying there. And I'm looking up at Arnold. And I just went, wow, this is just mad. You want to talk about pinch yourself moment? That was it. Me lying in the savior of mankind's lap, looking at Arnold firing this cannon up at this helicopter. That was just an incredible moment and an incredible year, really, where I thought, okay, we're here, where we need to be. We've got there, you know.
So I said a little while ago, if I wasn't a lawyer, I'd want to be an actor. And that's exactly why. I don't get the full story. Schwarzenegger. So when Schwarzenegger, you and him went to the gym,
yeah.
I'm saying that you cycled together, right? So
that's right. Through. Yeah.
It's a real moment. You're on a bike behind Schwarzenegger,
yeah.
Riding to the gym.
Yeah, we'd get up in the morning and I'd go down to reception and then meet them in the restaurant, him and a small entourage of people. And we'd have an orange juice and a croissant. And then we'd all get on these cycles and cycle to the gym, you know, and it really was that. It was like he had this amazing, you know, kind of semi-electric bike which was shipped over for him, and we were all on the putt-putt cycles, you know, the ones that you hire. But it was fantastic. I mean, it was literally, again, it was pinch yourself moment, because I'd be behind him in convoy, about eight of us, and then we get to the gym, park the bikes up, walk into the gym, and the whole gym would just go absolute stillness as he walked in, and just, you know, and it was extraordinary. And then, you know, and then he said, right, you know, come on, let's get training. And so I had Arnold Schwarzenegger training me. And it was, I'll tell you, what I'll say is that, you know, they say, be careful about meeting your heroes because you never know what you're going to find. Well, I'll tell you what, both him and Linda, they were as nice as you would imagine. They were so generous. They were so welcoming, and it was a real moment in my life, you know, meeting those guys. You know, I met another fantastic actress that I've worked with several times now is Mila Jovovich, and you know, again, she's just the most amazing individual, amazing, you know, open, generous. She's the captain of the ship, and it all feeds down from the top. Do you know what I mean? If the people at the top are kind and generous, then it will filter right the way through. And that's what I found with those three actors. They're amazing human beings.
You've worked with Idris Elba as well. So
yes,
I mean, because I remember one of the films. Sometimes in April. Rwanda and the Hutu tribe, and I mean that right there. One of your earlier films, I think.
Yeah.
What was it like working? What was it like working with someone like Idris, who's now, you know, an A-lister as well?
Well, Idris was, at that time, he was emerging as a lead actor. And if I'm not mistaken, that could have even been his first lead role. But, you know, I'd known, obviously, as an actor, you're aware of people like Idris and David Harewood and, you know, Adrian Lester, Lenny James, these guys that are out there doing it. And so I was aware of Idris, but I'd never met him. And then we met in Paris on the way there, and he was surprised to see me, and I was, like, surprised to see him. And then we just clicked. And I remember it was a heavy movie, that Sometimes in April. It was about, Rwandan genocide. And we were shooting on location in some of the locations where that genocide had occurred, you know. And so one of the museums they have there is a church where, you know, you walk into the church and it's untouched. It's as it was when that madness was taking place. And we both arrived in Rwanda on Christmas Eve. We were so furious with the director. It was like, what are we doing here on Christmas Eve? You know, so it was like away from the family, and that was crazy in itself. But then we arrived at the airport and got a folder, a massive folder like that, and just said, here's your research. So started playing with that, through with that. And then on the same day, we went to this museum/church, you know, and we both walked in there and saw it and heard the stories, and then we walked out and we were just absolutely in silence, you know. And I think we both recognized at that moment that we had a huge responsibility, you know, to represent what had happened there in the right way, without ego, just playing the characters in the right way. And so the first day we arrived on set, we were both in army uniform, and it was before, it was just the beginnings of it, of the madness occurring. And Idris came over to me and he said, so what do you want to do? And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, I'm thinking, let's saturate. And I said, yeah, what do you mean? And he said, saturate that cinema screen, every pixel on the cinema screen, we fill it right out. I was like, wow, okay, yeah, I'm up for that, you know. And so that's what we did, and we did it very well, you know. We got on very well. We were best of mates over there, and you know, and subsequently I've done, you know, Yardie with him, and, you know,
I was about to mention Yardie. He directed Yardie, didn't he? But by the time you met him that time, he was now a very well-established actor who'd gone into directing.
Yeah.
So, and were you seeing the same Idris, or you know, had he evolved into
you know, much? That was a funny story as well, because I just come back from Grenada, and I was at home, literally just unpacking, and then I got an email, and I saw a number that I didn't recognize, so I went into it. And it was just one word, saturate. And so when I saw saturate, I was like, I replied immediately, always. And then I sent it back. And then he called me straight away, you know, and he said, where are you? And I said, I'm in London. And he said, well, I'm in Jamaica, where I'm filming Yardie. And I said, okay. And he said, I need you over here. So I was like, okay, I've just come back from Grenada, you know. So he said, no, look, the deal is, I was meant to be playing the lead character, one of the leads, the supporting lead, Piper, but I'm directing and I'd rather just focus on that. So I need someone I can trust to step in, and that's you.
Wow.
I was like, wow, okay. So, yeah.
But yeah. Saturate stayed there, it stayed in your mind. And it was the same word that he used again. So obviously there's something really powerful in that. So you've done TV as well. Before I get to TV stage, because film, big screen, but no immediate interaction with the audience. In terms of confidence and courage, stage, you're right there, is far more intimate. Just what would you say is the proudest stage performance that you've been involved with?
Ah, wow. I mean, that's a difficult, you know what? Okay, so I would say the proudest moment I've had on stage was at Shakespeare's Globe. And it wasn't necessarily because of the performance that I did there. It was more about how I got to that specific moment during that performance. And I was stood there in the pouring rain, looking at someone acting opposite me. And I considered that many years ago, I'd been in Chalk Farm walking through the streets, and this guy had jumped off a bus and he ran over to me and he said, you're that guy, you're that actor. And I said, yeah, my Fraser. And he said, oh, well, you know, I want to be an actor. So I said, okay, so what do you want to do? And he said, well, it'd be great to get some advice, some help from you. So I said, yeah, here's my number. And I gave him the number, and I looked at him as I handed it over. And I said, listen, the moment you're considering not calling me, that's precisely the moment you have to call me. And he did. He called me, and we kind of worked together. I worked with him. I got another writer, Che Walker, another actor, Hugh Quashy, to come in and work on his scenes. We worked his scenes together, and he got into RADA. And so he got into this amazing drama school, and then I was in contact with him after drama school, just talking to him about the long game, because it's like that. It's like a roller coaster ride. Sometimes you're working, sometimes you're not. And we were doing that for just over a year. And then I walked into the Shakespeare's Globe to perform in King Lear. And on the first day of rehearsal, I walked into the room, and there he was. There he was, wow, sitting in the room. Beru Tessima is his name, and he's a wonderful actor. And actually now he's screen acting tutor at RADA as well, you know. So, but the point of that story is that he was in that show with me, and he was playing, you know, one of the messenger roles. And there was this point during the play where I come out to receive a message. And yeah, it's Shakespeare's Globe. There's 1,700 people there. I mean, that day, it was absolutely teeming it down with rain. It was late at night, we're under the lights, and he's running through the crowd, and I'm on stage, and he's coming through the crowd, and he comes to the front of the stage, and he's standing there with rain just dripping down his face, and he's delivering this message to me, you know, as Ozzy Albany. And I looked at him and I thought, this is just incredible. Here's this guy I met on a bus, and here we are together. You know, here we are together at Shakespeare's Globe, one of the foremost, you know, international theatres out there in the world. And here he is. You know, how one moment can lead to another moment, can lead to another moment. And so when you talk about proud moments, that was the proudest I've been on stage, you know.
Because I suspect there'll be some other actor coming through who may say to him, you know, I'd love to be able to connect with you. And the way he responds to that will be, yep, the lesson that he learned from the way you respond to this. So you've done Globe quite a few times, including King Lear. So we are talking about, you know, significant productions at Shakespeare's Globe, the home of Shakespeare. I mean, how we've gone through Rwanda, African accent, Yardi, Jamaican accent, and now we're at Shakespeare's Globe.
Yeah.
So how do you managed to evolve from one role to the other with such confidence?
Well, that's why I went to drama school. I went to drama school because I wanted to be classically trained, because I'd bumped into acting, a complete accident, just literally bumped into it. And then I found, oh, I'm loving this, and it's not costing me much to do it at all. And actually, it turns out my performances are having quite a profound impact on the people that are watching it in the theatre, you know. And so I decided that one of the things I did want to do was Shakespeare, but I had no training in Shakespeare, absolutely clueless about how to speak verse or those really difficult words in the language of Shakespeare, you know. So I wanted to remove the fear that I had about it, and so I knew that the way to do that was to go to a classical drama school. So I applied for several, and I got into a few, and I went to Guildhall School of Music and Drama, and you know, it's a classically trained school, and I had the best time of my adolescence, you know, training at Guildhall. It was everything I expected it to be and wanted it to be. And I still, to this day, use parts of that training. I call it the drama school cupboard. You know, when you get a role and you're thinking, it doesn't immediately come to you what your instinct should do with this role, you can open up the cupboard, you can have a look in there, and you say, I have a bit of this, a bit of that, a bit of this, and you can build a character from that, you know? And so, yeah, when going to, I think we did over 200 shows at Shakespeare's Globe. You know, I worked at the National, wow. I worked at the National Theatre, at the Royal Court, at Regent's Park Open Air Theatre. I actually love theatre. I do love it. It's just that I got to a point where I was doing so much of it. I felt, you know what, I've done a lot of it now, and I need to kind of focus on the film and see if I can get a few movies under my belt, you know?
So I've seen you in theatre a few times now, and I remember in the early days, I think it was Black Heroes that you did.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And that was powerful. Because did you? I recall as well. You played Malcolm X.
Yeah.
I mean, so this is in the early days, and I remember watching you close up, thinking. In fact, the words that Idris used are exactly right. You saturated this. I could just feel you immersed. You were Malcolm X. You know, it was just a tremendous passion. And the reason why I say that is because I'm going to come back to Guildhall. In a few minutes, but to get to that level of performance and intensity takes something. So I think people will be surprised by the fact it wasn't as if you were always en route to becoming an actor during your school years. But before we get to that, TV. So you've done your Holby Cities, your Judge John Deed, I think you've done Death in Paradise, 24 with Kiefer Sutherland. So of all the TV performances, what are the ones that stand out for you? Because there even a bit of comedy as well, I think. Life After Birth. what are the key ones?
The key ones for me are actually, so Prime Suspect 2 will always be close to my heart because it was almost directly from leaving drama school that I got that role. And it was an immense role to play. At the time, and it was an amazing series at the time. So I did the second Prime Suspect, and again working with Helen Mirren, super generous. She taught me so much, just simple things that I'd love to see her tell her this, you know. But you know, just little things that she taught me about the mechanics of being an actor on set, you know, about where you have to hit your mark, how you hit your mark, how you can, you know, you got a mark on the floor that you have to hit in order for the focus to reach you and be sharp. So you have to hit that mark every time you're doing a take. And there are various ways to do it. Some people use a peripheral view. And she taught me to go to the mark and then take three steps back from the mark. And then you won't have to look at it because when you walk forward three steps, you'll be bang on that mark. And then, you know, when they say, you know, take a step to the side, a step to the right, she says, you know, sometimes you don't have to take a step. You just lean. And the lean is enough to put you in the focus, you know. So she had loads of those kind of gifts for me. And Prime Suspect was, you know, it was an immense role because on the page, you know, it said Tony Allen crying, Tony Allen sobbing, Tony Allen completely broken down. I was thinking, how the hell am I going to do this? You know, but I'd worked with an actress called Anne Mitchell in the second year of drama school, and she really gave me the keys to the emotion, how to access emotion, and I used some of her exercises to play that role, and so. That was I mean, pretty immense as a part.
Now, I was going to say, there's another part that I remember so well, which was when you were in Baby Father, and I remember it well, particularly because of the posters, the billboard posters.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, we were talking about that the other day. I was talking to Dave Hereward about it the other day. We were saying, actually, if we had to do it again, we probably wouldn't do that now. Yeah, I came back from skiing. I had a skiing holiday. Came back from skiing. And I looked up this billboard and there's, you know, four black guys with the butt naked in the shower, you know, shot from behind. And, you know, I mean, we thought at the time it made sense because, you know, it was a new show and we wanted to get it out there and people to be kind of engaged with it right from the beginning. But actually, it was a bit of a strong campaign. I probably wouldn't do that again now, you know.
But it stuck in my mind.
Yeah.
So can we go to the first run? You're one of four boys?
Yeah.
Born and bred, North London, Camden.
Well, actually, I'm one of five boys. Five including Louis, my half-brother. And then Kim, half sister.
Okay, and born, raised South London,
North London. Yeah,
I wish it was South London.
North. Yeah, come on, Trevor. You must remember. You got to remember that the banter we used to have back in the day about.
Struggle, you know. Although Camden's fine, I love Camden. So can you just tell us a bit about what life was like, you know, growing up. School was like, and you know, you left school I think at 16, did you?
I left school in the I did my A-levels. Let me just say, first of all, growing up, I grew up in Chalk Farm, Camden Town. I was born in Camden Town, Camden Square, and then I grew up around, you know, a mixture of a triangle of Camden Town, Regent's Park, and Chalk Farm. That's kind of where we grew up. And I would just say that I always talk about growing up in the 70s because it was the time of hippies. And there were at least two hippie colonies around Chalk Farm where we lived. And we used to hang out there all the time. Those guys were just so relaxed, so welcoming. And it was a kind of a halcyon moment in time. You know, it was just the best time growing up around there because, you know, mum and dad were working, we were latchkey kids, we would go out in the summer holidays, we'd go out in the morning, play all day long and then come back for dinner and that was it, we were out, you know, and we were getting into all kinds of mischief and frankly, how we survived it is incredible because, you know, you got the obvious dangers of just the things that kids get up to. But then, you know, the other dangers of kind of turning down the wrong road and who you meet and that kind of thing, you know. But actually,
racism.
Yeah. I mean, there was, you know, growing up, there were several times. Colin always said, one of my brothers always said, there's a time to stand and there's a time to run. And always recognize that, you know. So there were many times we were running, you know. And a few times we were standing as well. So, yeah, growing up there was I had the best time. I think all the group, well, I'm still in a group, a WhatsApp group with the guys I grew up with. And I think we'd all agree that it was the best kind of childhood, you know, it really.
It's interesting because for some people, the racism which we experienced, which was real and daily and threatening, for some of us, it's become a fuel. It's given us that resilience and determination. And for others, it's kind of really sort of broken them and made them feel quite disenchanted. But in you, it was a fuel. Because you talk about it as if it was what it was, but it certainly wasn't going to stop you. Right? You take the positives from it. So you went, was it O-levels back then?
So we did O-levels and then I did A-levels. My A-levels were simple ones, you know, art, English and film studies. And that was interesting because I never, even then, I wasn't anticipating that I'd have anything to do with being an actor. It was just an easy A-level to do, you know, so I did film studies. And art was an easy A-level to do, so I did that, you know. I had no idea I was going to be an actor at that time. But I left school and then I went to work for this kind of
the Advertising Standards Authority, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, before that, I was at a computer kind of software company, And then I ended up at the Advertising Standards Authority and was there for about 4 years, which a great place, lovely people. Met a wonderful man called Ronald Dewar, who, when I finally realized that actually acting was what I wanted to do, and that came around because I was entirely bored with going home every day and being a TV addict. So I knew it was on every side, and I just wanted to do something different 1 year. So I went to the City Lit to see what courses they had. And actually, I wanted to do a course in fencing because I always loved the shapes of fencing, you know. So I went there to do that course, and they said, no, the places are gone, you know. So I was leaving the building, and as I was on the threshold of the door, I thought, come on, man, you know, there's got to be something else here. So I turned around and I looked at the board, and there were a list of courses on the board, and drama was just flashing like a beacon. It was just there. So I went to the drama department and met a lovely woman by the name of Valerie Colgan. And she said, oh, sorry, love, you know, those places are gone. People queue overnight to get those places because they're the closest evening course to a drama school training. So I was like, oh, wow, you know. And she said, well, you know, don't worry. I'm a director at the Old Vic Youth Theatre, and we're doing a South African play, and I'd love you to come and audition for it. So I said, okay, you know. So a couple of weeks later, I went and auditioned, and then she gave me the lead. And I was like, I remember saying to her, I said, what? I can't do the lead. I can't play the lead. You know, I'm not experienced. I don't have. She said, trust me, you can play this lead. You know, and she gave it to me, and we worked over it weekends over 3 months. And we put a play on at the Jeanetta Cochran Theatre. And, you know, my aunt and my mum came to see it one night. And essentially, this character got caught up with the wrong crowd. And then, you know, a South African play went into Johannesburg and ended up kind of doing mischief and put his hands up to this crime of killing this guy, this priest that was coming down the stairs. And the judge got his black cap on and, you know, tomorrow morning, Absalom Kamalo, you will be hung by the neck, and bang these gavel down. And then from nowhere, I heard this voice say, no, he's a good boy. You can't hang him, he's a good boy. And I was standing there, I was thinking, I swear that's Auntie Helen's voice. Can't be Auntie Helen, you know. And I think, yeah, it is Auntie. And then I heard my mum say, Helen, sit down, sit down. And she's pulling Auntie Helen down. So I finished that play, and I went and I said, were you? And she said, I don't know what came over me. And I just found that was the wildest moment, that my aunt, who knows me, who I grew up around, could seriously stand up in the middle of a play and pull me and, you know, and shout at the judge, you can't hang this boy. And then my mum's pulling her down. And that was it. I had the bug of acting, you know. So I went back the following year to the City Lit, and I stayed overnight, and I got my place in that course.
Wow.
And then I went to drama school, you know. Yeah.
But you didn't just go to drama school. You smashed it. You had so many offers from different drama schools when the opportunity came.
Yeah.
It wasn't as if you could have this. I mean, did you?
I think I recognized that because I left school and started work, and I'd been in work for several years, that decision to leave full-time work, when frankly at that point I was just about to get a mortgage on a place, and then I told my dad, and he said, you know, are you crazy? What are you doing? You're just about to buy a place, and you're now, you know, stop. You're knocking that on the head and going to drama school to act. And I said, yeah, I this is what I want to do. You know, so I was very determined. And I remember I would walk into those auditions, and there were people in the room, and they would all be talking to each other, and you know, and then people attempting to talk to me. I'm sorry. You know, I wasn't there to talk. I was in the zone, focused in the zone. Because when I went into that room, I knew it was thousands of people applying for those places. And, you know, you had to make your mark. And I did. Every time I walked into the room, I destroyed it. I mean, I really did my absolute best in the moment work, you know. And so, yeah, I did. I got offered several places and I chose Guildhall because Guildhall, to me, the moment you walked into the building, first of all, it was in the Barbican, this lovely area of London. And then you walked into the building, you could hear trumpet and opera singing and piano. And it was just a building that there was work going on. And I knew I was going there to work and I wanted to be in that environment of activity and work, you know. So, yeah, it was an easy choice.
The reason why we started with that top rung, we were talking about Schwarzenegger, Idris Elba, we were talking about appearing at the Shakespeare's Globe. And then if you strip it right back to how you started, you weren't, there was no particular interest to become an actor, and you made your way through your studies, and then you had this sort of desire to go into acting. And when you went for it, your mindset was such that this is what I'm going to do. I'm gonna make it. No messing around. Despite the fact that in your childhood there would have been racism and all sorts of things, you were just utterly focused to be the best you could be. And when you connect those two things, it just tells you the importance of mindset. Mindset and confidence. So just the middle now of this ladder, obstacles and challenges. And what is it that led you to create Underexposed? What was behind that? What was the motivation? And if you could tell us a bit about what Underexposed is.
Okay, so I mean, I remember we'd finished filming Baby Father and I was at home one afternoon and there'd been this, you know, drive-by shooting in Birmingham and I was listening to a radio talk show, you know, and they were, the premise of the show was, well, the reason why there's black violence in the black community and low achievement for black school leavers is because we have a lack of black role models in the UK. And I was listening to that thinking, hold on a minute, I mean, I've just finished Baby Father, you know, four male leads and then the female leads in that and then black director and sound man and editors and writers and, you know, I feel like there's a few role models there. So what nonsense are they talking? You know, so I was trying to get on the phone to have a conversation about it. I never did, but several weeks later, I went to an awards ceremony. We were nominated for some awards and we went to the Grosvenor on Park Lane and I was stood in this room amongst some of the most, you know, highly talented actors and editors and directors you can imagine, you know, from the black community. And I thought, how dare they suggest we don't have black role models in the UK? They may not be as visible as they are in the US, but they are absolutely in existence. And what we need to do, what I need to do is to find some way of exposing them and sharing who they are, you know. And so I just had a light bulb moment that I would do an exhibition and call it Underexposed. And in order to expose and we find, you know, these talented photographers to take these amazing pictures. And then another little light went on. And I thought, wouldn't it be great to have their names on the posters? Because what would happen is, you know, you'd go, I'd be walking down the road and someone would say, oh, you're that guy from, you know, and it's only kind of, really, to be honest, in the last, I would say, I've been acting now 30 years plus, and it's really in the last 10 years where someone will come up to me and say, Fraser James, and I'll be, wow, yeah. You know? And so I thought it's important to have their names on the posters, you know, and then also, ideally, a gem of knowledge, something that comes individually from that person that they would want to share, some words of wisdom that they might want to share to inspire others. And so, you know, I kind of worked it with a couple of people, Ulrich Riley and Louise Dakota and then Franklin Rogers came on board and we just created this amazing thing. And, you know, we went into the National Portrait Gallery and we said, look, we deserve to be here. And we want this portrait collection to be a part of an exhibition here. And they said yes after many meetings, they agreed. And then I thought, well, you know, that's great, but the audience that we want to see it aren't necessarily going to be coming into the National Portrait Gallery. So we need to make it a public art installation. And that's why I ended up in Peckham and subsequently became the Peckham Portraits. And then, you know, they were up there. They were meant to be up there for a couple of months and they ended up being, you know, on the roadside on Peckham High Street and Commercial Way for almost 10 years, you know. And then, you know, coming back to the project in 2018, you speak to people like John Boyega, you know, Letitia Wright, you know, who grew up in that area. And John, I was talking to John and he said, you know, I can't remember when it was, but I used to walk past those portraits every day and there was a moment where I was inspired to be an actor. And I thought, you what? And he said, yeah, it gave me goosebumps because I thought, there we are, we put this thing out in 2008 and we didn't know how long it was going to be. It ended up being there for almost 10 years. And at some point, this guy who I became aware of because he'd got this lead role in Star Wars. And I remember thinking, wow, there's a black guy going to be one of the leads in Star Wars. And he's from the UK. Isn't that incredible? And then I come to find out that he was inspired to be an actor because of work that we had done how many years ago. It was just the most amazing moment, you know. And so we're still running Underexposed Arts, as you know. It's a charity now. And we collaborate with artists to produce exhibitions, talks, installations, public art installations that go nationally up and down the country to inspire others. And you were a part of the second collection of portraits entitled The Next Gen, you know.
I'm really proud to be part of it, not least because of what it represents. You know, and it's now backed by Amazon. And, you know, when I look at the image you sent me, just so you know, I mean, my career has gone to heights I never expected. First black senior partner in the country in the top 100 firm and all these different things. But when I look at that portrait, it's something that makes me feel incredibly proud because I feel as if I've been captured in this, and that I'm there to be seen by others to inspire them. Not least, it's symbolic in a way. What you've created symbolizes, you know, achievement and success and endeavor, but also the artistry. I mean, Franklin Rogers' artistry means that it's just these are just perfect pieces. And I think now when I think about it, when I think of black excellence, I look at that picture. If ever I feel a bit down, and it picks me up. It picks me up. And you said something to me. And we talk about saturations. I love that. I don't know if you remember what you said when I was posing for my portrait. You said it's in the eyes. It's in the eyes. And there was something of that statement now when I listen to you that has followed you through your career. It's in the eyes. You said the meaning, what you feel, how you're feeling comes out in the eyes. And I sense that from your acting, how you're determined to do the best whenever you're on stage, whenever you're in a film. But now what you're doing is you're being the ladder. And you're inspiring so many other people to come through. And I have to tell you, Fraser, I'm sure this has been said to you many, many times before, but you are somebody who has made a huge difference. And you're also somebody who has proven that given a fair opportunity with the right mindset, you can succeed. And you certainly do triumph if you believe. I want to thank you for taking the time out today and for being such a brilliant, brilliant inspiration. Thank you, Fraser.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here. And, you know, you know it's mutual, Trevor. I mean, you earned your place in that collection of portraits. You know, you earned your place. You're, as you mentioned, the first black partner in the city. The work, I've followed the work that you've done for years, made laws in the House of Lords, you know, and to me, you are someone to look up to, and you're someone that others would be inspired by. So having you to be part of the collection was a no-brainer. And I love what you said about the eyes, because I think, you know, where I am right now in my career is that I've got to a place where I fully understand my craft. You know, I understand it. One of my favorite actors, of course, is Denzel Washington. And when I look at Denzel and I look at his performances, there's an actor that understands his craft. He understands what he needs to do. He's not going to be fazed by any direction any director can give him. And that's what I feel like at the moment. I feel like I've done so much work now that I can work with any director, any actor, not be intimidated by that moment, and actually deliver my best work. And then the next job, it will be the next best work. And that's what it's all about, you know.
Well, thank you, James. Thank you to all of those that have been around us and supported us.
Indeed.
And thank the Windrush Generation. Thank you for joining us for the You Triumph podcast. I've been your host, Trevor Sterling, and this has been a journey of triumphs and the mindset that makes them possible. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, like, and leave a review. Your support helps others discover the show and the valuable insights shared. Join us next time as we continue to unravel the stories and strategies for succeeding in life. Remember, you triumph if you believe. And if you've achieved, one must not aspire simply to climb the ladder, but to be the ladder.